From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Movie villains are bad, but their homes can be very, very good.
And that's really, I think, what these layers do. I mean, they make the villain have this accessory that makes them seductive to all people and demonstrates their power.
Chad Oppenheim picks his favorite layers for evildoers later in the program. First up, we're going to talk about the lairs of two South Korean families, the Rich Parks and the Poor Kims, whose lives intersect in a house that is a central character in the story. We're talking about the movie Parasite, directed by Bong Joon-ho and an Oscar favourite with nominations for Best Director, Best Picture, Foreign Language Film, Original Screenplay, Editing and Production Design. Without giving too much away, the Kim family works for the Park family. The Kims live in a cramped sub-basement apartment, while the Parks live in a gorgeous minimalist home. And what unfolds is a story about class that is expressed through architecture, as director Bong told KCRW's Kim Masters through his translator, Susan Choi.
기본적으로 내가 이제 영화 감독이니까.
You know, as a filmmaker, I'm always interested in space. I'm very obsessed with space. And when I find a good space, I become almost pathologically excited and euphoric. And space is, you know, dominated by architecture. So even with the Rich House of Parasite, we talked to actual architects, and the production designer and I really thought a lot about the architecture. And for one of the interviews I did in the States, we actually went to a Frank Lloyd Wright house in L.A. and conducted the interview while walking around the house. It wasn't like the Rich House of Parasite, but it was a very memorable day just walking around that famous building with very low ceilings.
The Parks live in a spacious, minimalist, light-filled home. Was there a specific Korean architect on whom you modeled your fantasy architect? I don't know how to say. Namgung Hyeonja?
Yeah. It's a fictional name. I created the name. 근데 그 영화에 나오는 집의 스타일은
So the style of the Rich House is based on an actual architect. His last name is Kim, although a quarter of Koreans are Kims. But he is a very successful architect with a lot of young rich clients, like CEOs of IT companies, well-paid professionals like lawyers, and he has clients like the Parks.
You used a minimalist look to symbolize the wealth.
The house being minimal was very important in first part because it's tied to the character of the rich couples, these sophisticated and modern young people. But more importantly, you know, a minimalist space makes you feel like that all you see is all there is to see, that you get the sense that it's not trying to hide anything beneath the complicated layers. The simple planes and the lines come together to make you feel like you've seen everything. And that's why, spoiler alert, when you see the man in the bunker and the hidden parts of the house, it's more shocking for the audience because you assume that you have seen everything and nothing is hidden.
So then you, of course, contrast with this very tiny sub-basement with very limited light and no views and cluttered space.
그러니까 그 말 그대로 뭐
And with the semi-basement home, you know, the opening shot is the only time you see sunlight pouring into that house when they're searching for Wi-Fi. And in all, you know, semi-basement homes, you only get around 10 to 30 minutes of sunlight a day. It's very rare. On the other hand, with the Rich House, you know, the sunlight pours in like a waterfall. There are many scenes with abundant sunlight. And so it's class disparity shown through natural light. And with sound mixing as well, you know, we try to show class disparity through sound. Where in the rich neighborhood, it's all quiet. You hear birds chirping. And in the poor neighborhood, there's endless noise. The house functions as a character, like a main character in this film. It's a character that has a lot of secrets and layers, a character with very deep darkness. And if we say Ki-taek, the father of the poor family, is the protagonist of this film, the house ends up swallowing our main character. You know, you can say that Parasite is a story about a man who tried to go up the stairs but ended with him ultimately going down the stairs. And at the end of the film, you know, Ki-taek basically crawls into the stomach of the basement of this house. He's a character that, you know, is being swallowed by the whale and is stuck in its intestines.
That was Parasite director Bong Joon-ho speaking through his translator Susan Choi to KCRW's Kim Masters. Now, the movie's production designers prompted a lot of questions. Does the Park's house really exist? Do Koreans often live in semi-basements? How come affluence these days is represented by a sleek minimalism? We turn for answers to Yi Sung Yi. Yi is a partner at Morphosis Architects, based in Culver City, and he is helming the design of the Korean-American National Museum, which will be located at Vermont and 6th in Koreatown. We were very curious to get his reaction, personally, as a Korean-American, and as a big fan of director Bong Joon-ho.
And when I saw it, it became really personal because for a short period of time, I was living in that semi-sunken apartment where the little clerestory window, the height of that window was measured by the diameter of the wheel of the car that would park next to my window. And then during the winter, it would go dark because the snowdrift would actually obfuscate that window. So I was very much empathetic to living in that.
You lived in one, but is that a kind of a regular form of dwelling in Seoul?
I would say it's a very unsophisticated version of a type of maybe the half-sunken brownstones that you might actually see in New York and in Boston, where you have a level that's half down and half up. And I think it was an attempt to actually maximize the number of dwellings per unit. But clearly, it is actually the more cheaper option, and there is some sort of a stigma attached to that. And then, of course, later on in the movie, as you go up to the affluent parks, it is no surprise that it was actually up on a hill because that was very much emblematic of a neighborhood in northern Seoul called Seonbuk-dong and maybe Poam-dong. That is where the more financially affluent residents live. And clearly the fact that the house was behind a walled compound, the little gate, and the immense kind of investment in the gardens. And so that when you're inside the house, there is a complete obfuscation of all your other neighbors. And that's how basically all these grand houses are designed, these villas are designed up in the hills.
I took one look at the house and I just thought that's sort of international good taste minimalism.
I think the architecture itself right now of the villa represents a very contemporary snapshot of what the affluent society deems as great architecture. I think the luxury of having pure space, the luxury of having exquisite rich materials that are lining the primary spaces within the house, was 100% geared toward this type of affluency. And there's like a huge shift when all of a sudden for me, I noticed that there are no rugs. There are no carpets, right? Everything is hardwood floor. Everything is basically a high level of stone finishes. And that is right now the larger trend toward these huge villas going forward. And as we all know, the amazing thing about this movie is every single space piece in the movie was all constructed. So for me personally, as an architect and as an urban planner, that moment where they go from the high house and go back to their house during that rain scene, that entire vertical descent, for me to understand that as a complete artificial construct in a stage set was just incredible because it was such an allegorical moment in the movie. I mean, as a matter of fact, the entire movie is one big allegory from the characters to the architecture.
So you are a fan of the director's work, and his previous films, you mentioned already, are equally fabulously
designed.
No, it's incredible. I mean, for me, 4 to 5 movies mark him for me on my own personal understanding or me following his movies. The first one was one of his first major hits called Memories of Murder, which was a recreation of the serial killer event that happened in Korea. And there you got a real true test of him tackling on a murder genre. And then after that, of course, is the huge monster hit called The Host, where he was able to take advantage of Seoul's infrastructure and unapologetically embrace the monster genre in a really successful way. I would say the Snowpiercer and Parasite are clearly, of course, his social commentary on social hierarchy that has haunted and has divided and has given identity to Koreans. So Snowpiercer being horizontal, Parasite being vertical.
So one of the unintended consequences of modernist thinking is that somehow modernism or modernist houses became synonymous with social pathologies. There are so many movies where the bad guy lives or works in a stripped down, modernist, seemingly soulless space. Even though the Parks are not a bad family, they're not murderers. However, one does get the sense that they're a somewhat anxious, perhaps unhappy family that don't seem to be that well connected to each other. And there they are in this sort of relatively cold space. The Kims, on the other hand, live in their tiny space full of sprawl. The water gets in. They look out on the alley. They've got their tiny chink of light. And yet, until things do turn, spoiler alert, rather bad for them, up to that point, you do get the sense that they're kind of a happy family.
And a united team.
They're a united team. So their circumstances, their architecture, which is chaotic nonetheless, has not made them an unhappy family.
Correct. And I think with the Parks, clearly you see an incredible a curated collection of items, which probably also means each other, that they have to have, right? They have to have these specific two children. I mean, obviously the Kims too, but I think probably for different purposes, the artifact of all the equipment in the kitchen, the appliances, the type of sofas, right? All the furniture, absolutely. And those things are highly chosen for their synagogue-graphic purpose.
So interesting. And then flip question, if that movie, that story were to be told about Los Angeles, which it absolutely could be, we have extreme affluence and we have extreme poverty, we have thousands of people living on the street, where would you situate that story in LA? And how would you tell it architecturally?
You know, it might actually parallel the structure of architecture that I saw in LA Confidential. So how like the Lovell House, I would say you compare the Lovell House, Neutra's Lovell House.
Richard Neutra, of LA's most important and influential modernist architects.
Correct. And if you look at the structure of LA Confidential, is basically a slow vertical rise from basically downtown LA and basically all the SROs, the single residential occupancy apartments from that era, and how it slowly goes up to the hills, the lower hills of like Los Feliz, and then it ascends to the top of basically Hollywood Hills up in Griffith Park. So I would probably take that vertical structure and apply it.
The Lovell House being the topmost
of
the locations.
That's probably where I would have put that. Or you could also go to the Ennis Brown House, which of course has been the subject of many, many films too.
Right. But Blade Runner also told a social class story through
Correct.
Architecture, and they had the poor on the ground and they had the rich up high in towers,
exactly.
Which could be future LA.
Future LA.
That was Yi Sung Yi. He's a partner at Morphosis Architects, and he was reflecting on the movie Parasite. He is designing the Korean-American National Museum that will be built in Koreatown. We'll tell you more about that on future shows. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, how come movie villains always get the best houses?
At At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Movie villains may want to blow up the planet, but they have great taste in architecture.
You live well, Scaramanga.
At $1 million a contract, I can afford to, Mr. Bond.
In The Man with the Golden Gun, James Bond goes to meet his nemesis, Scaramanga. He lives in a palatial estate hidden away on his private tropical island. Hideouts such as this one were a big turn-on for Miami architect Chad Oppenheim, and it inspired him and his wife Ilona to produce a new book. It's called Leia, Radical Homes and Hideouts of Movie Villains. In the introduction, he wrote that they were interested in the houses of truly awful movie villains, not just the pretty bad guy. We started there with the question, what is a truly awful movie villain?
Well, I think a truly awful movie villain is not just your you know, cat burglar or someone who's, you know, maybe killed someone accidentally, but someone who's trying to make massive change at a very large scale, oftentimes with grandiose visions of how the world could be a better place according to their principles.
And often genocidal aspirations.
Yes, very large amount of collateral damage is typically in the plan. Not that it's their necessary objective to kill people, but they have a mission. And as a result of that, there are typically many, many casualties.
So your book is broken down into the villain and then the building in which they inhabit, be it workspace, home, whatever. Give us a range of who you selected, and was there a type of villain's lair that you were attracted to?
Yes, well, I guess I'll start with the villain's lair because that was really the genesis of the selection criteria. But essentially, I was looking for architecture that was inspiring, and I might have been formed by many of these villain's lairs as I watched movies, predominantly James Bond, Star Wars, even Blade Runner. That began to kind of inform things that I thought were very interesting and very cool, if you will. And that's really, I think, what these layers do. I mean, they show power, they show style, flair. They make the villain have this accessory that makes them seductive to all people and demonstrates their power. So, you know, there was a lot, there were a lot of villain layers that we didn't particularly like. So while we did include Star Wars and Darth Vader in terms of the Death Star, we did not show his castle on a volcanic planet because it was a place that you just didn't want to go and hang out.
It struck me looking at the book that there is a kind of architectural theme running through your layers. What would that be?
Well, there's a bunch of different layers and different typologies of layers. There's layers like Lex Luthor in Superman, where he basically recommissions Grand Central Station or beneath Grand Central Station.
It's open. Come in. My attorney will be in touch with you about the damage to the door. Otis, take the gentleman's cape.
Then there are layers that are these immersions within nature, these secret hideouts, almost like an animal's. And that's like another definition for the word lair. It's like an animal's kind of secret place to hide out and away from prey. So there are those layers, which I find actually the most interesting, which are embedded in beautiful nature. So you have Scalamandra from The Man with the Golden Gun, which was really the movie that set off this fascination for me. And it was the first James Bond movie I had ever seen. And then you have other incredible houses like in Diamonds Are Forever, which is in the Elrod House by John Lautner, whose work is very much about nature and architecture meshing together, which is a central theme in my own work, is how architecture and nature can establish this incredible relationship.
Well, hi there. I'm Bambi.
Good morning, Bambi.
And I'm Thumper. Is there something we can do for you?
I can think of several things.
And Ken Adams, who is the production designer, who's also, you know, one of the most prevalent figures in this book and a tremendous influence for my own work, he played around with that, the notions of sort of bunker, modernism, high-tech, power, brutalism, and then mixing it with this sort of very comfortable domesticity.
You just mentioned the late Ken Adam, highly esteemed production designer, worked on many of the Bond movies, which raises a question in terms of the layers that you have selected. It seems as if there might be a mix of not real, as in production design for a movie, mm-hmm. but they seem real, that we think the hideout exists, as well as real buildings. And Ken yes. Adam certainly worked with both. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, indeed he did. And sometimes Ken Adams was using a Lautner house in the production set. So of like Diamonds Are Forever, that was a Lautner house. So Ken Adams was just the man. I mean, this guy had an incredible vision. And, you know, he escaped Nazi Germany. So this idea of architecture and totalitarian power and the expression of architecture to use that to promote this power was something that was very, very close to Ken Adams, and somehow that he channeled that into these incredible creations.
Which brings me to one of the most fantastic villains' lairs, which is the war room in Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, the war must sing for you. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
What is yes. I mean, that is just the gold standard of totalitarian power.
And also White House Gone Nuts.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a funny little anecdote that when Ronald Reagan actually became president, he was getting a tour of the Pentagon. He's like, I want to see the war room. And he was referring to that.
The war room from Dr. Strangelove, which was yes. a set designed by Ken Adam. Yes. But tell us what made it so villainous.
Well, you know, it was really just an incredible, sleek, very powerful, very, you know, geometric shapes. The lighting was very kind of intense, where it was kind of just focused over this war room table. It had an incredible shape to the room that kind of brought your eye to the center of the space. It gave you a visual on how government and military and other things can kind of be visualized in terms of their kind of power, in terms of domination and architectural prowess.
But the architectural prowess came through an overlay of two geometries. It was a triangle table
and a circle, and yeah.
it within a circle. Mm-hmm. And therein yeah. lay the drama.
It is. There's, you know, I think you can really create a lot with very simple forms and simple shapes. And that's something that we draw on a lot from our own architecture, right? There's a tendency today to sort of let the computer do many, many aggressive things. But I strongly believe that this monumentality can be achieved with very simple and powerful geometries.
Let's talk about a movie from more recent years, which was very, very compelling, Ex Machina. And that villain's lair.
It was incredible. And that, as you said, it was really a fascinating movie. But then again, you know, many of these villains, they all believe that they're right. They all believe that the future that they are going to shape is the way life should be. And here you have an incredibly wealthy tech entrepreneur who kind of combines, you know, Mark Zuckerberg-esque type of you know, procedure, and he's living in this wilderness that's supposed to be Alaska. And I think, like, one of the most interesting lines, it's kind of relatively in the beginning of the movie, is when he asks the helicopter pilot who's flying him to this to the home of the protagonist or the antagonist, and he says,
"How long until we get to his estate?"
"We've been flying over his estate for the past 2 hours."
So it's this idea of kind of owning a large swath of nature, larger than anyone. And then the house itself, is very silent and very hidden within this beautiful nature. So to me, that's the ultimate show of like respect for the environment, but almost also this idea to kind of play God and manipulate nature in a way that is, you know, very, very much about overpowering it. But there's a sensibility that it's about silence and being discreet as well. Even though he had the land to build a huge palace or a castle or something, it was a very hidden laboratory that was nestled within this beautiful nature.
How often are villains' lairs, at least in the ones you've selected, underground?
A lot of them have a component that is underground. I mean, of course, the Death Star is not underground, it's floating. Although one of the Death Star iterations was actually embedded into a moon and was carved out and into the ground in that particular iteration. You know, there's a real incredible fascination about hiding, about tunneling, about caving, about, you know, nestling within. So this idea of underground, even in that, in Ex Machina, there was a underground component. Parts of the house were above ground. And there's oftentimes a duality about what happens above ground versus what happens below ground. There were some other homes that we were looking at. I think in one of the movies that there was a killer. It wasn't involved in the book because the guy was just a serial killer. And that house also had like a very modernist and very beautiful upstairs, but downstairs it was like where the killing happened and it was a secret place. So when you're building and you want to hide things, the underground is always a very good example of a location that would work for those activities.
Now, your book itself has a kind of aspirational quality about it. It's certainly a rather glamorous book. We should say that it's hardcover. It is all black with images and text in silver. Why did you choose that aesthetic?
Well, the graphic design team felt that it alluded to the sort of movie imagery of film, that it had this sort of movie quality to it. It also created a kind of universal language because obviously every film has its own color temperatures and cinematography. So we wanted to sort of create it in a more analytical understanding of everything based on architecture and not necessarily based on cinematography or other features of that. So we really wanted to kind of neutralize everything to be understood from its own powerful architectural expression.
We've routinely referenced bad guys. Are there any bad gals in this book?
Unfortunately, they're not. You know, I guess there are characters who are associated with the supervillain. Like in the movie The Incredibles, the woman Mirage was his sort of diabolical sidekick, if you will. And oftentimes there are women involved in the experience themselves. But many of these guys are single, and these are very much like the ultimate bachelor pads.
That was Chad Oppenheim, founder of Miami-based Oppenheim Architecture and Design and editor and publisher of Lair, Radical Homes and Hideouts of Movie Villains. He'll be coming to LA next month for some book signings. Watch our website for details. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with a final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business, for sharing her interview with Bong Joon-ho. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.